From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller could be submitted within days, detailing the investigation into possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians in the 2016 election and maybe obstruction of justice. Now, Mueller has kept his nearly two-year investigation largely under wraps, though it has resulted in a slew of criminal cases, sentences, guilty pleas, and a conviction of Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, on fraud charges. Joining us now is Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democrat from California. She's on the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Congresswoman, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And what are you hearing about when the Mueller report is going to be coming out?
Well, we don't have, you know, a direct conduit to the special counsel, and we get our information much like you do through leaks or the media. So I don't know any more than you do at this point. It appears, based on what Mr. Whitaker has said and others, that it's coming to a close. But we don't know what kind of a close. Is it a progress report? Is it a full report? Is he going to put forth a roadmap of criminality or be very narrow in the way he looks at the issue?
What do you expect it will be? Do you think it's going to be sweeping indictments? Do you think it's going to be just a kind of wrapping up the things that we already know?
I actually think that there will not be an indictment of the president because the Department of Justice has these guidelines, and I think he's going to comply with those guidelines. I would not be surprised, however, if he provides us with a roadmap that shows the criminality of the president. I think the obstruction of justice issue is a huge issue in this case, you know, along with the overriding issue of did Donald Trump as a candidate collude with Russians. I think that when you look at Donald Trump, the man, you see someone who has never played by the rules. And I don't think he's playing by the rules today. And that's why there are so many investigations that will be ongoing by various U.S. attorneys in various jurisdictions around the country. I think there's over 18 of them. So, you know, in plain sight, we can see how Donald Trump, the man, operates. And I think Michael Cohen's testimony next week is going to be very revealing. I think, once again, we're going to have the benefit of tapes that are going to tell us a lot more about Donald Trump, the businessman, entrepreneur, willing to not play by the rules. And it should be, I think, a pretty clear path for members of Congress to say, do we really want a president who does not follow the law?
So if there is a case being made in this report that there was collusion, or if there's a case about obstruction of justice, does the House then move toward impeachment? Do you think that there's going to be enough support for that in the Democratic-led House?
The Mueller report will be the foundation, and then I think the investigations that will go on in the Judiciary Committee and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and probably the Oversight Committees will be the triad that is going to provide us with the details. I don't expect that the new Attorney General is going to be forthcoming. I think he's already signaled that. He may give us some summary, which will then force us to rebuild the construct so that we can move forward, if appropriate, with an impeachment proceeding.
But do you think that the report will be leaked if he redacts a lot of it or just gives you a summary?
I think over time the report will become public. It always seems to. I mean, the Pentagon Papers is a great example
right.
as well. But I don't know if it will be forthcoming, you know, in the next 6 or 8 months.
Do you think it's at all possible, Congresswoman, that this report would be seen by Democrats as a dud, that they do not find that the president did anything wrong?
I don't think you can ever identify this investigation as a dud. The men closest to the president when he was running for the presidency have been criminally liable. They have either been convicted or have pled guilty. He has surrounded himself with people who have no compunction to lie. And I do think that what we have with Paul Manafort is a strategy now that suggests that I'm looking for a pardon. I am not going to be forthcoming as I should be because I want that pardon. And the sharing of polls with a Russian operative by the Trump campaign is a serious violation. And the fact that he lied about that. There is more to that story, and he is now just clamped up because he's looking for a pardon from the president.
That is Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democrat from California, member of the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Well, now to news about a new White House panel that aims to question government reports concluding that climate change is a threat to national security, saying those reports haven't been rigorously reviewed. According to a leaked memo, the White House drafted an executive order forming the 12-member panel to be led by William Happer, who's claimed that rising carbon dioxide emissions, which scientists say trap hot air in the atmosphere, are a good thing. Here he is on CNBC in 2014.
The demonization of carbon dioxide is just like the demonization of the poor Jews under Hitler. Carbon dioxide is actually a benefit to the world, and so were the Jews.
Let's bring in Scott Waldman, a White House reporter focused on climate change for E&E News, that's Energy and Environment News. Scott, William Happer is an emeritus physics professor at Princeton. He's on the National Security Council. He has been widely condemned by the scientific community. How stunning is this?
Well, it's not stunning in the sense that Happer has been on the National Security Council for a number of months now, and this has long been a goal of his. He wants to create a debate around climate science that's not there in the field, but it's there among skeptics and deniers who want to sow doubt in the public's mind. So this is a way for him to create a debate around climate science that doesn't really exist.
Well, and this is something that others in the Trump administration have attempted. Scott Pruitt, when he was the head of the EPA before being scuttled, wanted to do red team exercises. These are usually used to review military operations. He wanted to use them to review the government reports on climate change. That was scuttled by former Chief of Staff John Kelly. Now this proposed panel, which could start very soon. Tell us more about Happer and his beliefs.
Well, he believes that the world is in a CO2 drought, a carbon dioxide drought, and that we need more of it, that it'll help plants grow. There's plenty of research in the field that shows that actually crop growth and crop yields will be harmed by more CO2. So he holds outsider beliefs, to say the least. He is a physics, emeritus physics professor at Princeton, but he is not a climate scientist. That hasn't stopped him from making all sorts of claims and critiques of the field of actual climate scientists who've been working for decades studying this. So he's trying to bring these ideas. He was an integral part of the red team idea under Scott Pruitt. And so he's doing it here just through the lens of national security.
Well, and this leaked White House memo, first reported on by The Washington Post, highlights the many recent government reports. There was the 2019 Worldwide Threat Assessment asserting that climate change will likely fuel competition for resources and social discontent. There were the 2017 and 18 National Climate Assessments, huge scientific reviews, conclusive evidence that burning fossil fuels is heating the atmosphere, causing wildfires in California, crop failures in the Midwest. According to reporting, this White House memo says that those reports have not had rigid review and therefore this panel is needed. The Pentagon also issued reports on the threat to national security. Bases will be underwater. What, if anything, have you heard about reaction to this within the government, given that this is the government panel that's questioning the government reports?
Well, I don't think among the intelligence agencies that this will be popular. I mean, this is the way that they need to look at and examine the risks. And they've actually been studying climate change and how it could affect national security for decades. So this is nothing new for intelligence agencies. They don't look at any of this through the lens of politics. All of the world's top science agencies expect that there will be widespread refugee crises and for millions of people being displaced as a result of climate change in the coming decades and centuries. And it's certainly beyond time to prepare for it. So this group is clearly an absolutely partisan effort. One of their goals is to conduct a, quote, rigorous, independent, and adversarial scientific peer review.
And that word, adversarial, is in there.
Yeah, and that's and you're right to pick up on that. That's a really key word. That's not how peer review works. All of the research that went into all those major governmental reports and the UN report on climate change, they are based completely on peer-reviewed material. And to look at climate science through the lens of an adversary is not how science works. And clearly, it's just an absolutely partisan exercise, which is in line with Mr. Happer's recent career when it comes to climate science.
Well, we'll have to see what happens here, because Congress had language in the defense policy bill in 2017 saying that climate change is a direct threat to the national security of the United States. So we'll have to see how this panel squares against Congress and all the other government reports.
Just a few weeks ago, Dan Coats, the intelligence director, came and testified before Congress that climate change will increasingly pose a national security threat. So that's Trump's own appointee saying this.
Well,
it's certainly not partisans.
Well, that's a whole other story. Dan Coats is his appointee for now. Scott Waldman, White House reporter,
yes,
focused on climate change for E&E News. Scott, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, there are reports that the president is very unhappy with Dan Coats. But we'll follow the story.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday, and among the 8 nominees for Best Picture, 5 seem to have a distinctly political feel to them, maybe a political message. Joining us now to talk about that is NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you. And, you know, the Academy Awards are all about rewarding artistic achievement, but this year, a lot of the nominees do feel pretty political as well. And I want to go through some of them, starting with Vice. Now, this is about former Vice President Dick Cheney, played by Christian Bale, written and directed by Adam McKay. And here's a scene where candidate George W. Bush is trying to persuade Cheney to accept the vice presidential nomination. And Cheney has some ideas about what kind of vice president he could be. Let's listen.
Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
He just sounds like Dick Cheney when you hear him there, but
he really does.
This movie is about the Bush administration, but it really does draw parallels to the Trump administration.
Yes, and you listen, Adam McKay thinks that everything that is wrong with America today, you can trace back to Dick Cheney, and he makes a good case for that, and he makes a very specific case for it. He wants you to see things as harbingers of what we have now arrived at.
He shows that the powers of the presidency were expanded after 9/11, thanks in part to Dick Cheney.
Right, and consciously expanded, that they went out of their way to create a presidency that was stronger than the other branches of government.
There's another film in the Best Picture category that really goes after the Trump administration a little more directly, and that would be Black Klansman. This is about a real-life African-American, Ron Stallworth, who infiltrated the Colorado chapter of the Ku Klux Klan by posing as a white man in phone conversations with Klan members, including David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Here's a scene with John David Washington as Stallworth and Topher Grace playing David Duke. Stallworth has just told Duke a story about how his white father forbid him to play with a black child when he was a boy.
Well, your father sounds like a terrific man.
He was a true American. Taught me what was right.
This is why we need more people like you and me in public office. Get this country back on track.
Amen.
For America to achieve its greatness again.
Absolutely.
For America to achieve its greatness again. You couldn't get more direct there,
No, it's very specific. And, of course, there was a reason. This movie, I am hesitant to talk about the end of it because it is a very powerful moment. But this movie, there's a reason that this movie came out almost to the day, 1 year after the white nationalist rallies in Charlottesville. And it's a history not just of race in this country for the last, I don't know how many years, I mean, since 1970 when the film is set, but it's also a history of Hollywood's take on race pretty much throughout. I mean, there are scenes from Gone with the Wind, from Birth of a Nation, from Shaft, from all kinds of films. And for me, as a film buff, it's a fascinating tour through how we've been instructed to feel about race all these years. And obviously, you see the roots of where we are today in where we have been in the past. And Spike Lee is expert at drawing the parallels there.
There are a couple of other Best Picture nominees that also take a look at race in America in very different ways. Mm-hmm. Of course, the big blockbuster Black Panther, a superhero film that takes place in the fictitious kingdom of Wakanda. It has a character, Eric Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan, who is Wakandan, but he was raised in Oakland, California, and has experienced racism all his life. So when he becomes king of Wakanda, he wants to use the kingdom's resources for a little payback. Let's listen.
We're going to send vibranium weapons out to our war dogs. They'll arm oppressed people all over the world so they can finally rise up and kill those in power and their children and anyone else who takes their side.
Bob, what do you think the political message is with Black Panther? I mean, it was a very entertaining movie to watch, but there's also a message there.
Well, Wakanda was conceived as a place where colonialism and institutional racism had no sway. And so it's a world of Afrofuturist skyscrapers, flying maglev planes, and these incredibly powerful women. And it's a society that you look at and you just marvel at, and it's gorgeous and wonderful. And you can totally understand why someone would identify with that world. It is also a society that prizes family. You see flawed fathers and uncles who have issues and things like that. And you see the response to this man who is like the nephew or the cousin or whoever who's gone on the wrong track somehow, mm-hmm. and that the whole family is trying to pull him back. That is a familial thing that will reach to all kinds of people, not just to the Black audience, but to everyone who watches it. It is instantly identifiable and there's a reason that this movie is so huge. Mm-hmm. Everybody can identify with the things in it.
We're going to move on to Green Book, but I need to note that you did just say that you could marvel at Wakanda, which was very well-used term there by you, Bob, on a Marvel movie. Okay, so let's talk about Green Book, which looks at the relationship of Jamaican-American pianist Don Shirley and his driver, Tony, who Shirley hires to drive him through the Jim Crow South in the early 1960s. And in this scene, Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, takes Tony to task because Tony's hot-headedness has landed the two of them in jail.
So that little temper tantrum, was it worth it? You never win with violence, Tony. You only win when you maintain your dignity. Dignity always prevails.
Does it speak to today's political climate at all, do you think?
I think this is a movie that you could have made any time in the last 40 years. And that it is about a somewhat dated view of race. This is a Italian character from the Bronx who is shown to be racist at the beginning of the movie, and he forms a friendship with Don Shirley. So they've solved the problem of race, right? Because they've gotten rid of a man's prejudice. That isn't how that works. And I think to some extent, everybody who sees it wants it to be like that. I mean, you can't not, but it answers questions that are sort of separate from the way we experience race in this country today. And it feels old-fashioned to me.
Okay, let's talk about The Favorite. And I'm not talking about The Favorite, which is another film, but the one that a lot of people think is going to win, which is Roma. This is Alfonso Cuarón's film about his childhood that also has a little bit of politics in it. It takes place in Mexico, which, of course, has gotten a lot of attention because of the whole fight over the border wall. And then it focuses on a woman who is basically a servant taking care of a middle-class family. What do you think about this one?
Well, this is an interesting – the more you know about Mexico, the better off you are watching this. And I'm not suggesting that you should do homework beforehand, but the fact that Alfonso Cuarón is making a film about his own childhood in a way. He's, mm-hmm. he's depicting a family that's very much like his, but not focusing on his character, which would be the little boy in it. He's focusing on the maid who was also the nanny to the kids. Mm-hmm. And she's an indigenous woman, and she's impoverished by comparison with this middle-class family. And in the course of the movie, a lot of things happen, and there's a lot of social ferment around them. They actually depict the Corpus Christi massacre. The government mm-hmm. of Mexico at the time was authoritarian and was cracking down on student protesters, and a lot of them were killed. And that features in a big way in the course of the film, as do a lot of other things that make you conscious of class and class differences. And, of course, there is also the fact that Mr. Cuarón, as he goes to accept his awards in a variety of places, and pretty much everybody is giving him the Best Director award this year. Mm-hmm. As he goes around and he's accepting it, he is referring to his pride in his nation and the accomplishments of the people of Mexico. And there's no way to hear that in today's world without hearing it as an implicit criticism of the Trump administration's policies and on the border.
What do you think about the fact that so many of this year's nominees feel like they are trying to send some sort of political message?
It's funny. I went back and looked at last year to see if we could have done this same discussion of mm-hmm. politics. There was Three Billboards, which mm-hmm. was very much a story of race. There was The Post, which was about press freedom mm-hmm. and specifically a woman in power. There was Get Out,
which was very much
about race. Absolutely. So last year, you could totally have done this conversation about politics and what the messages Hollywood was sending. At this time of year, every year, we are talking about the movies that Hollywood thinks are important in some way. And the reason they think that they are important is that they do have underlying messages. The reason the world is interested in them has nothing to do with those messages usually. It has to do with the art of those films.
Well, I just tune into the Oscars for The Host, so I can't wait to see who it's going to be this year.
Yeah, well, you got a problem, kiddo. I know, and the interesting thing is there are so many things that, you know, you don't have a host. You don't. For a while, they were going to give away some of the most important awards during commercial breaks. They've rescinded most of the things that they were going to do that were not good ideas. And I frankly think that if not having a host means that you don't have 18 minutes of monologue, this is a great thing. So I guess we'll see.
That's NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Bob, thanks so much.
It's been a real ball this time. She told me it can break your heart out
and put you in misery. This song, by the way, is featured in Black Klansman. After watching it, I immediately downloaded it. It's Here and Now. And I'm telling you,
it's too late. Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Actor Jussie Smollett has been arrested on charges that he lied to police about being the victim of a hate crime. He alleged last month that two men attacked him while he was walking home to his Chicago apartment and that his attackers were wearing MAGA hats, that's Make America Great Again, and that they were shouting racist and homophobic slurs while pouring chemicals on him and putting a noose around his neck. Well, today in a press conference, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said that Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism to advance his career.
Smollett paid $3,500 to stage this attack and drag Chicago's reputation through the mud in the process. And why? This stunt was orchestrated by Smollett because he was dissatisfied with his salary.
His salary, by the way, Yashar Ali of the Huffington Post reports that Smollett was paid $65,000 per episode of the most recent season of the show Empire. Joining us now is WBEZ criminal justice reporter Patrick Smith in Chicago. Patrick, you were at the press conference. Tell us more about what we learned today.
Well, we learned a lot more about the investigation, how the investigation into this alleged attack unfolded. Police said that there were about six core detectives working on this, that central to the investigation were surveillance footage, both police surveillance cameras and private surveillance cameras, that they used records from ride-sharing services to try to figure out the people who were with Smollett when this alleged attack happened. We also found out that the turn in the case happened after police questioned two brothers who knew Smollett through the show Empire. They were brought in for questioning on Friday. Today, police said that it was then, during the interview there, they were in the police station for almost 48 hours. It was during their interview there, with the help of their attorney, that they came to believe that this attack was staged. As you heard, that they were paid $3,500 mm-hmm. to help stage this attack.
Has there been a response from Smollett's legal team?
Well, so far all we've got from them is a statement saying that Smollett deserves the presumption of innocence like anyone else, saying that they're going to thoroughly investigate this and mount an aggressive defense.
As you said, a lot of resources were put into this case by the Chicago police. And here's the superintendent, Eddie Johnson, saying more about that.
You know, as I look out into the crowd, I just wish that the families of gun violence in this city got this much attention, because that's who really deserves the amount of attention that we're giving to this particular incident.
How do people in Chicago feel about all of this?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. You know, I think many people are condemning Jussie Smollett for this, you know, presuming that it's true. There's also, I have heard that from people, what Superintendent Johnson said there, that they wish the attention was focused on other problems in the city, other crimes in the city. I've also heard from people, you know, there are people who are complaining about the resources the police department used here, saying that that should have gone to investigating, you know, shootings or murders here in the city. Johnson said today that no resources were taken away from investigating other violent crimes to investigate this. But people are certainly, they feel like it's a distraction, whether it distracted the police or the public. They do feel like we were focused on the wrong thing.
Well, we are going to be focusing on a lot of the big issues in Chicago next week as we broadcast Here and Now from WBEZ. We're going to be hearing some of your reporting as well. Patrick, see you then. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, feel free to rock out. Aerosmith was one of the biggest stadium bands in the world in the 1970s. Shout out to Maxanne Sartori, the DJ who championed them. But then came the cliché, drug addiction for lead singer Steve Tyler and guitarist Joe Perry, infighting. By the 1980s, rock's bottom. And as Aerosmith fell, rising hip-hop stars Run DMC passed them in the other direction.
I'm the king of rock, there is none higher. Sucker MCs should call me sire.
But while Run DMC had hits, they didn't have airplay. No hip-hop group did. Then in 1986, Run DMC producer and Aerosmith fan Rick Rubin had a thought. Maybe a mashup could help them both. Specifically, the Aerosmith monster hit off the Toys in the Attic album, Walk This Way. Rubin thought Run DMC already used the beats at the beginning. Maybe they could put their spin on the lyrics. The subsequent joint venture, Aerosmith and Run DMC, made rock history. Walk This Way was a mega hit. It put hip-hop in the mainstream and, coupled with sobriety, relaunched Aerosmith. For Run DMC, different story. Washington Post arts reporter Jeff Edgers has researched this story within an inch of its life in his new book, Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. Jimmy Kimmel tweeted out, for music fans who can also read, this is a good one. And Jeff Edgers joins us in the studio. Jeff, remind us of this moment.
What's very hard to understand today when hip-hop is part of every element of our culture, from merchandising to television to everything, that there was a point where rap was just not in the mainstream, that if you wanted to hear it, you'd listen to a college radio station or you'd have to really seek it out. And this song is, I mean, if there's a line between before and after, this is the moment.
Yeah. And a moment, too, that's hard to, it's just hard to think of Steve Tyler, who we see, you know, gallivanting around the world now on the arm of various people, that he couldn't, I mean, gallivant, he could barely move.
Yeah, I mean, this book, I hope, accomplishes, you know, sort of resetting history in many ways. There's a false idea here that Aerosmith, the rock gods, came in and helped Run DMC become popular. And what in fact happened was Aerosmith, the fallen rock gods, who were really in terrible shape.
Oh, they were Icarus. They had flown too close to the sun. Their wings were completely burned off.
And Run-DMC, they were the first rap superstars. Before this record, they had already sold a couple million of their previous records. So they were already, and they were young and energetic, and they were rising. Mm. I would say they saved Aerosmith. And they were kind of the sacrifice for that. This wasn't great ultimately for Run-DMC, but for Aerosmith, it just totally relaunched them.
Well, we'll get to why it wasn't as great for Run-DMC, but in the meantime, let's listen to a little of one of their biggest hits, Rockbox. My name is Joseph Stevens, but my middle name's Warren. And when I'm rocking on the mic, you should all applaud because we're willing. Talk a little bit about Run-DMC. Start there. Joseph Simmons, Run, the brother of Russell Simmons, the producer and manager. Daryl McDaniels, DMC, a comic book geek, as you say. Jason Mizell, Jam Master Jay. What a sad story there. And just tell us a little bit about the group.
Well, Run-DMC emerges in the early 80s, and basically in clubs, there is hip-hop. You've got DJs as early as, like, you know, the mid-70s, but there was no actual music industry for hip-hop, because what would happen is you'd have these great groups and DJs and MCs in the clubs, and then the record company would come in and sign them, and they would turn them into disco with some rapping over it. So people always think of Rapper's Delight as, you know, one of the first hip-hop songs, and it is, but it's really a disco song with rapping over it. From sun to sun and from day to day, I sit down and write a brand new rhyme, because they say that miracles never cease. I've created a devastating masterpiece. I'm gonna rock the mic so you can't resist. Everybody! You can listen to Rapper's Delight, which is by the Sugar Hill Gang, and then you put on Sucker MCs, which is one of Run-DMC's first songs, and it's startling, the difference. What Run-DMC did is they took the sound of the playground and the club, and they actually put it on record. 2 years ago, a friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme. So I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there, but then it went this way. Took a test to become an MC, and Orange Crush became amazed at me. So Larry put me inside, scat to lack. The chauffeur drove off and we never came back. You had a beat and you had the rap over it, but you didn't gloss it up with a bunch of R&B stuff.
Or with Aerosmith. You didn't mess it up with Aerosmith, because what's hilarious is Run-DMC knew of the beats that open Walk This Way. Let's hear them again. Okay, so they knew this. They loved this. They took the beat. But as soon as Steve Tyler started singing, they thought, what?
Run-DMC didn't even know there were lyrics in that song. They knew it as Toys in the Attic, number 4. What happened is Rick Rubin, he gives them the record, he gives them a yellow notepad, and he gives them a pen and says, go to Daryl's basement, listen to the song, and write down the lyrics. And that's the first time they say they heard the words, and they did not like it. They called it Hillbilly Bull. We know what comes next, you know?
Okay, so then you come to this moment that they're all coming into the recording studio. By the way, Steve and Joe split $8,000 for this session to come in.
Right.
They didn't want to be there. Run-DMC didn't want to be there. They were worried about a rental car that they'd misplaced. But what did happen that gave it this? We'll have the video at herenow.org. You see them split by a wall, one on one side of the wall. What a metaphor. The others on the other side, like two recording studios, and they start hearing each other through the wall, and they're trying to break through the wall.
You're talking about the video.
Yeah, the video.
Right.
Where'd the spark come from that created what was obviously a great recording?
Well, the spark is this. You have Rick Rubin and you have Jam Master Jay. He's like a calming force, and they're really in control of the situation. But, you know, it's hard to explain why good art comes out of something, like why you go to the symphony one night and it sounds electric, and then the next night you go and it sounds flat. They just happened to be in a moment, that March 9th, 1986, where that beat and the energy in that room, whatever, created something special. The song was too good and the artists were too good.
As we say, it made history, revived Aerosmith. But as you point out and you talk to people in the book, it wasn't as good for Run DMC. Some people thought maybe, you know, they kind of sold out by doing this and maybe didn't have to. Maybe they would have had the success they were going to have anyway. But suddenly they are attached to this other group. I mean, what was the thinking about why it wasn't as good for them?
They could have just fizzled out anyway. It was such a big hit for them that you couldn't help but not do as well the next time out. And I think once that happens, people say, oh, so they're not selling as many as last time. And also you have Ron and Daryl, who really had some conflict. And, you know, Jam Master Jay was tragically killed in 2002, an unsolved murder. So that basically ended it. No amount of money. I think Daryl said, I wouldn't get back together with Ron for $200 billion.
Okay, well, that's pretty definitive.
Right.
But together, they made history. Jeff Edgers, the book is Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, said today he is closing the country's border with Brazil and considering closing the border with Colombia. That's because a caravan of opposition lawmakers led by Juan Guaido, who claims to be the president and is backed by the U.S., is on its way to the Colombian border to allow aid to come in from the U.S. Maduro has blocked that aid, claiming the Trump administration is using it to orchestrate a coup against him. NPR international correspondent Eder Peralta is reporting alongside the opposition caravan. Eder, describe the scene where you are.
So right now I'm just outside of Caracas on the main highway. We're following three big tour buses that are carrying opposition MPs who are headed to the border. It's a really long trip. It's going to take them probably all day and into the night. And I spoke to a number of them. I asked Amar Adrián, who is one of the main organizers, if she was scared. You know, they've faced lots of repression before. And she told me she was, but that they've already suffered a lot, and that the decision to go through with this has already been made. And that was made the day that Juan Guaido declared himself president. And so she says that they are at the point of no return right now. They're going to the border, they're getting the aid in, and they have no other option, she says.
How are they going to do that once they get to the border? How will Guaido allow the shipments in?
So that's one of the big mysteries here. We're not sure at all. The opposition has been very quiet, but they say the aid is coming in. And all eyes right now are on Cúcuta, which is on the Colombian side of the border. And, you know, the government has placed big blockades on the big bridge between Cúcuta and Venezuela. And, you know, we have really no idea how the opposition plans to get aid in. They may not do it in Cúcuta is part of the thinking, but we're not sure. We have no idea.
Meanwhile, there's a big push to get the military to defect from Maduro. That has not happened yet. They're still backing the Maduro government. What are the fears right now about violence between the opposition and people who support Maduro?
Well, I think that is the biggest unknown, which, you know, the country has already seen some significant defections. An Air Force general defected earlier this month, and yesterday the defense attaché at the UN defected. So what happens when the military is confronted with orders to stop this convoy, which President Nicolas Maduro has already said? Do they stick by Maduro or do they not? That's the big question, and I think also the big fear that Maduro has told his military, do what you must. He's treating this as a foreign invasion, and he told them, do as much damage as you can to these invading enemies.
We were speaking with someone the other day who was a former chief of staff to Maduro before Maduro became president. And he said that the division is so great in Venezuela, that the country is so divided, that it's going to be impossible to get the entire military to back Guaido all at once. Do you see the division? You're there with the opposition caravan, but do you see that divided country in Venezuela now?
Not in the popular sections. I mean, I have been to the big slums that used to be purely Chavista. They would support Maduro, and now they've turned on him. You know, and today I was in Caracas as the opposition caravan came in, and, you know, there were no opposition protesters. There were a few supporters. You know, I met Maria, who only wanted her first name used because she feared retaliation, and she was smack in the middle of the highway. Cars were whizzing by, and she was shouting, holding a Venezuelan flag, Libertad, freedom. And I asked her if she was scared. Let's listen to a bit of what she told me.
No me da miedo, no me da miedo. De verdad que no me da miedo. Mire, yo, a mi hija, yo tenía una sola hija y me la mataron.
So she says, I'm not scared because my daughter was killed already, and so why should I be scared? And I think that's representative of what I've been hearing a lot here. Many Venezuelans feel that they have little left to lose, so they want to go out into the streets. They want to go out to the border. They want to force the military to make a tough decision.
And how do they feel about U.S. involvement right now in this entire effort to get Maduro to step down from power?
So there I have heard mixed reactions. I've spoken to people who say, you know, we welcome it. We need this to stop however it stops. And then I've spoken to a lot of people who say, look, we want Maduro out, but we don't want war. The government, government supporters are 100% opposed to this. The government has set up tents all across the country where people are signing an open letter telling the United States to keep their hands off Venezuela.
That is NPR international correspondent Eder Peralta reporting alongside the opposition caravan in Venezuela, which is making its way to the border with Colombia, where they want to allow a shipment of aid in. Eder, great reporting. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And it is so rare to hear from reporters on the ground in Venezuela, has been for many years, so it's great that NPR's Eder Peralta is right there. Here and now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.